Okay, I think we'll get started, everybody. I think there'll be other people coming in, but I think in the interest of time, we got to get started because we have to be out here around 5. So I want to thank everybody for being here. And an update on next week. On Tuesday, we'll have Peter Axelson speaking to us, and he's a engineer who lives in Nevada, and he's a wheelchair user, and he's a Stanford graduate, and has been around for a long time doing all sorts of very interesting things. And I just got an email from him this morning saying that he's been chosen to be a part of the U.S. delegation at the closing ceremony of the Winter Olympics with Joe Biden and Christy Yamaguchi and other notable people. So it'll be really nice to see him. I really encourage everybody to attend because he's a very good presenter. And next Thursday, we'll have the midterm presentations by the students who are working on team projects. And like everybody to be there, and you'll all be a part of their evaluation. So, please attend. And any other questions or comments? I'm sorry things went poorly on Tuesday with the webinar, but I think there was enough information that we finally got across. So, their website, the Lynn Graphical website, is very good and shows the product that Dick Steele was trying to demonstrate. So, anyway, at this time I'd like to introduce Jessica Rose, and she's we had her speak last year, but this time I thought it would be a good idea for us to come to her because it's doing a lot of very interesting things. So, her research focuses on neuromuscular and musculoskeletal systems, underlying gait abnormalities in children with cerebral palsy and other pediatric orthopedic conditions. And she directs the Motion and Gait Analysis Center, which we're standing in right now. And her research is focused on the energy cost of walking, muscle pathology, selective motor control, postural balance, and motor unit firing in cerebral palsy. And as you all know, walking is pretty important for getting around. So this is a nice topic for us to be involved in because that directly affects a lot of folks who have walking impairments. And and it's all the body's a mechanical structure, so it makes sense to do this. So I'll turn it over to Jessica.
So welcome to the Motion Analysis Lab, and here you can come. I was going to kind of orient everybody with a few slides about walking so that we are familiar with that, and then we'll go ahead and do a walking test. I believe we have a volunteer. And so this is a clinical service in the Lucille Packard Children's Hospital, and we analyze walking. Orthopedic surgeons, residents, engineers, physical therapists, and orthotists, and go over patient data that we the interpretations, and then make the treatment recommendations there at the gate round. So it's a nice opportunity to bring a lot of different. We also have a research program here that focuses primarily on neuromuscular deficits, palsy. And I may not get to that. I also teach a class, Anatomy of Movement, every winter quarter. And so we have a course that kind of focuses on the musculoskeletal system in particular and looks at it from basic anatomy and physiology as well as clinical applications and a focus on art as well and representation of movement through art. So with that intro, why don't you come here, and there are chairs around, so if you would like to sit down, just grab one from the waiting room if you like, and then we'll kind of clear it out when we do our walking test. So I wanted to cover... I'll just pause here to say, if you walk out today or wheel out with this sort of basic sense of what are the phases of the gait cycle and a sense of primary muscle actions during gait, and we may get to some common gait disorders, that would be good. But again, this is a shorter presentation, and so maybe just having this framework, it will... will help you orient to the topic quickly. And you may already know that motion analysis was pioneered here at Stanford, and there was a photographer, Edward Muybridge, who was hired by Leland Stanford, the former governor, in 1878 to settle a bet. And that bet was a question about whether or not all 4 feet left the ground at one point. Was galloping, and through setting up a series of cameras and wires, he was able to show in the third frame at least that all 4 feet did come off the ground. And that's true for running. It defines running relative to walking. There's always 1 foot on the ground when somebody is walking. So here's the gait cycle, and there is a stance and swing phase to a gait cycle, and everything that we look at in the lab, all the collect is examined with respect to the stance and swing phase. And so all of the graphs are shown in a percent of the gait cycle. You have a number of different subphases of the stance phase, and we would, for example, look at muscle timing in relation to these phases. So that is the gait cycle. I also want to mention we look at a number of different other motions, including reach and grasp, and we have a cycle that pertains to that, just because when you analyze motion, you need a cycle or a start and a stop phase to analyze it during. And so we've looked at the reach and grasp cycle. We've created a golf swing cycle. And so the concept of analyzing movement, it's important to recognize that you do need to establish and define a cycle that able to compare different people and between. So here's a quick overview of muscle activity during gait. You can see that at the very beginning of the gait, you have the initial contact, and it's normally with what? Yep, with the heel. And the stance phase is the first part of the gait cycle, and the swing phase is the last part of the gait cycle, and it refers to how the limb is moving, a single limb is moving. And one thing just to notice is that the muscles that cross the hip joint here and the knee are active right here around initial contact, so they're stabilizing the leg and getting your leg ready to accept weight. So that would be the gluteus maximus, there, the hamstrings and the quadriceps, all active around initial contact. And you also will see this muscle in front. Does anyone know what this muscle is right here in front of the shin? It's the tibialis anterior. The tibia is a bone in your lower leg, and it's the tibialis anterior in front of the tibia that prevents your foot from slapping down with each step. So if you have complete weakness of this muscle, you'll get a foot slap with each step. And so it slowly lowers the foot down. And then the gastrocnemius muscle and soleus here in the calf is active really only in the middle of the stance phase. And it's a very essential muscle because without it, you collapse into a crouch. And so it's actively working to hold the lower leg, keep the lower leg from rotating over the foot too much. And so it's very active here, preventing too much tibial rotation over the foot. So that's kind of the very, very important muscle. I think maybe you have a talk by an orthotist. And so, yeah. So an AFO, an ankle foot orthosis, can help actually fix the ankle, similar to what the calf muscle does. The AFO also, of course, prevents foot drop, which is the function of the tibialis anterior here in swing. So an AFO actually provides both of those functions. And then just finally, the hip flexor here. So right at the transition between stance and swing, the hip flexor is active, helping to flex the hip and knee as you're coming into the swing phase. And then again, these muscles around the hip and knee come on to stabilize the leg right before your initial contact of the next cycle. So that's the gait cycle. There it is. We have a heel first contact normally, but very commonly in cerebral palsy, the initial contact is not with the heel, it's with the forefoot. And this is because the muscle growth, I would say in a nutshell to describe what's happening in the case of spastic cerebral palsy, diplegic cerebral palsy just means that the lower legs are more affected or primarily affected rather than upper limb. That the muscle growth does not keep up with the bone growth, so that's very much a problem here in the calf muscle. The calf muscle is short, and you get usually some tightness around the ankle. It's weak. We've done a lot of studies looking at motor unit firing in spastic muscle, and the muscle is about only 25 to 30% of normal strength, normal ability to activate. And then, although you have weakness in the opposing muscle, the tibialis anterior, this shortening it causes the position here of this forefoot initial contact. And there's one other contributing factor, this very common gait deformity, which we call equinus gait, because a horse similarly walks on their toes. I don't know who came up with that term, but it's certainly caught on, is that loss of selective motor control occurs. So you have basically a loss of motor drive coming descending from the brain. It causes weakness. It causes the muscle not to grow as fast as the bone. And you have a loss of selective motor control. So you... the most common pattern of this is that every time that the quadricep goes on, so does the calf muscle. It's called obligatory coactivation. It's a synergist type. These are synergist muscles. And it could be just that there's not enough motor drive to inhibit this synergistic activity, which is what normally happens is you get reciprocal inhibition and synergist inhibition occurring at the level of spinal cord and above, that prevents this from happening. So if you think about the picture that you saw at the end of swing, the quadriceps on and getting the leg ready to take weight, right? So if every time the calf muscle is not supposed to be on here, but if every time this muscle goes on, this muscle also has to go on, what's going to happen at the end of swing? Any guess? So the calf muscle is a plantar flexor. It pulls the foot down. And so the foot is being pulled down every time, essentially, the quadricep goes on because they're coactive. So the quad normally goes on at the end of swing, but at the same time, so does the calf muscle, and it pulls the foot down. And so this is also contributing to this very common gait deficit.
Mm-hmm. Does the child's heel ever touch the ground, or...?
Well, it totally depends on the child. It varies. This is somewhat typical. So let's just move ahead real quickly. So we have controlled, the purpose of the calf muscle, again, was to control the tibia, this rotation of the tibia over the foot in stance, and that calf is working real hard there to keep the leg upright and really the knee extended. So if your foot is planted, the calf muscle is helping to keep your leg straight and prevent buckling of the knee. Okay, and here's just a quick example of, or a diagram of this little guy working so hard around the tibia, the lower leg, and pulling the calf muscle string and back and the tibialis anterior, and he's just working real hard here now to prevent the tibia from rotating too much over the foot. And this just shows that there's three rockers during gait that people identify with an axis at the heel, where the rotation is around the heel at first, and then the second rocker where the rotation is around the ankle, so the tibia is rotating around the ankle, and then the last rocker where the rotation, the axis of rotation is right there at the forefoot. And as long as the foot is fixed, this gives you a lot, generates a lot of plantar flexion moment and power, and it gives you the momentum to walk forward with. And so it's very important to fix that ankle, either with your calf or an AFO, to get that power generation there. And let's see, let's not worry too much about this. So this is just what will happen if you have a weak calf. You see, his tibia is not being held up in stance, and so it's falling too forward, and it causes a major common cause of crouched gait, is that simply the calf is too weak. Or what used to happen before we knew to be very careful is that the calf muscle would get over lengthened, and it would be a worse situation. So that was years ago. Thank goodness now we've learned a lot, and this is very rare. So there's swing phase. Just of interest is that your peak knee flexion and swing, you have to flex your knee, it happens very early in swing. And that's just all you might want to remember. And we'll see a graph of that very soon. In a gait analysis, we look at video, and we look at kinematics and kinetics, which you'll see those are the motion, the joint motion is kinematics, the joint forces are kinetics. We look at dynamic EMG, which is the muscle activity. We look at postural balance, which is something that we do on one of the force plate right here in front of the desk. We look at the one in front of the desk rather than the force plates that are embedded in the floor. And we look at energy cost while walking to get a global measure of efficiency during gait. So I'll just show this real quick. So this is a child with pretty typical diplegic cerebral palsy. And what do you notice about his gait? It rotated inward. Anything else? What about the knees? Do they get straight? Right, so he's... Right, so he's not achieving full knee extension, and he's not getting a lot of flexion either. Right.
Is that painful there with a child?
Not usually painful. Nope. It's fatiguing.
Yeah.
So here you're here, and you're going to see this. And so let's just move on. Here is an example of a kinematic graph that we get from what you're going to see in just a minute. And here is the hip, the knee, the ankle, and the foot of this child that we just saw. This is a single gait cycle from 0 to 100% of the gait cycle. Here's stance and swing. Think about it. When you first step, your hip is flexed. So flexion is upward. As you come through your stance phase, your hip extends, and then as you swing through, your hip flexes again. And similarly with the knee, you come in and your knee is normally very, straight. And this is the yellow line I should have mentioned. The normal line is the yellow line. And so your knee is very straight at initial contact. You get this loading response where the knee flexes a little bit and this happens with everybody, and then it extends fully or close to full extension, and then it bends in swing. And again, your peak knee flexion and swing, which is about 60 degrees, happens early in swing. And then you're essentially extending your leg and getting it ready. And we saw all those muscles on here around the hip and the knee getting ready to support weight as you kept into your next gait cycle. And in this case, the child is flexed. His knee is too flexed at initial contact. It stays too flexed in stance, and it does not achieve the full knee flexion and swing. So we might call this a stiff knee gait. So it's both a little crouched, and he's not achieving full knee flexion and swing. And so it's also a risk of tripping in this case. The ankle, not bad. So he was up on his toes, but in actuality, the ankle is fairly neutral. It's for the most part, it's kept, it's too plantar flexed. So plantar flexion is down here, dorsiflexion is up this direction. It's a little bit too plantar flexed, and especially here in swing. The actual position of the ankle wasn't horrible, but he was way up on his toes, and so that's something that you wouldn't necessarily know from seeing just these graphs. You would. Also, somebody noticed the internal rotation direction of his feet, and so this is internal rotation up and external rotation down. So that's what a kinematic graphs are. And I think with this last bit of orientation, this is a model that is very helpful clinically. We're using this. So in the gait rounds that I described. We will look at this model of the hamstrings in most kids, well, now all kids who have crouched gait. And the model was developed by Scott Delp and his group. And it looks at the length of the hamstrings during the gait cycle and the lengthening velocity of the hamstrings. And that's because someone can walk in a crouched gait for a number of different reasons. We talked about a weak calf muscle causing a crouched gait. It can, and it can be the only reason, and you wouldn't want to lengthen other muscles if it was due to a weak calf. Similarly, a hip flexion contracture will cause a flexed gait. So, again, wouldn't want to lengthen the hamstrings if the problem was, arising from hip flexion contracture. So this just shows, here you can see the model of the hamstring in red here. Attaching it crosses the back here, crosses both the hip and the knee, and so the length of the hamstrings, which are very important, is graphed here as a over a single gait cycle, and so the length of the hamstrings is longest at initial contact. So think about why that is. Your hip is flexed at initial contact. We saw that. And your knee is straight. So that combination of joint motions, yes, thank you, stretches the hamstring to its, a very long length for it. And this is where we run into trouble if you have a spastic hamstring or a hamstring the muscle growth didn't keep up with the bone growth. Again, this we don't quite know why this happens, but we know it happens. It's probably related to not getting enough descending signal and motor drive to trigger growth factors that would otherwise happen. And so you see this often cause of crouch gait, but you want to make sure as best you can that this is a cause. And so here in this graph, you'll see the normal range of length of the hamstrings, and you can see that this patient falls below that. And so this would be an indication that, yes, you would want to lengthen the hamstrings. But we see kids that walk in crouch gait where it's normal and we don't do the lengthening procedures. And it used to be that about a third of hamstring lengthenings did not improve the crouched gait. So this is not a good outcome, and it's why these kinds of models are so important, so that we really understand what's causing the deficit and can treat it strategically. That's my plug to you guys who might want to go into modeling. Okay, so kinetics is the forces that cross the joint, and just want to mention quickly that the ankle moment that's generated is probably the most, well, certainly the greatest moment that's generated during gait at any joint and any time during the gait cycle. It's your push-off moment as you're towards the end of stance. You generate this very important ankle plantar flexion moment to push you off to the next step. And if you walk with a forefoot contact first, you'll get this moment generated too early, and you might get what we call a double bump pattern. So instead of basically accelerating you forward, it's accelerating you upward or sometimes even backward, depending on where your body weight is over your foot. It's not helpful to have the moment here. You want your power generation to occur here at the end of stance. Okay, so I think that is enough of an orientation. We have a volunteer so that we can go ahead and collect a gait cycle.
Well, while that's happening, I have a question.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It seems like walking problems can have a multiplicity of causes.
Mm-hmm.
It could be muscle strength. It could be like neural, get the signals not getting to the muscles. And then there's pattern.
Right.
Generating these.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess the question is that since there's all these possible problems, I'm sure that there's a lot of different solutions based on what the problem is. I mean, you talked a little bit about surgical lengthening and things like that. What are some of the other techniques that are used to resolve some of these problems?
Mm-hmm. So I want to reiterate that actually all four of those problems occur in everybody with cerebral palsy, and they're all interrelated. So I just want to back up 1 minute and say, if you have we know from the studies that we do in preemie babies and looking at brain injury when they're 37 weeks gestational age before the normal time of birth of 40 weeks, that kids who develop cerebral palsy have injury in the part of the brain that the motor tracts run through. And so this injury causes a loss of motor drive and a loss of direct connections to muscles. And so that loss of motor drive and also can be sensory paths as well. But in spastic cerebral palsy, if you look at just to keep it simple, think about it as a loss of motor drive. You are getting all of those other symptoms. You're getting a failure of the muscle to grow. You're getting weakness because of the lack of motor drive. You're getting a loss of inhibition to that synergist motion movement pattern. And also you're getting a loss of inhibition, descending inhibition, to the stretch sensors. And so you can really account for spasticity, weakness, loss of selective motor control, and short muscle length and weakness with that singular injury. So it helps to think about it in that kind of model, and that would be separate from other types of cerebral palsy. And I should explain cerebral palsy is essentially, a condition of musculoskeletal development that occurs around the time of birth, and there's no other, more specific definition. It's a bit of a basket term. And so you have this, what we refer to as spastic CP, but there are other conditions such as dystonia and chorea, athetosis and chorea, which involve more of the sensory paths, and they have different set of symptoms, and they arise from different brain injuries, and those occur rather than the motor tracts They're the sensory and not so much the tracts as actually where the brain neuron cells reside in the brain. So that was sort of a long-winded orientation to get to the your question. Besides orthopedic surgery to lengthen the muscle, there are other treatments available, like exercise training, intense exercise training to strengthen the muscle, and there are other, like electrical stimulation is another, becoming a very important field to strengthen the muscle and to activate it, to sort of boost the signal at the normal time you would want it to be boosted. Electrical stimulation also is looking very promising for strengthening the muscle.
So that wouldn't occur while walking. That would occur while seated or something.
No, it would occur while walking. Oh. Now, in fact, we have a conference here at Stanford, April 23rd through the 25th, on FES assisted gait. So it there's been one or two trials of it several years ago as implanted electrodes in children with cerebral palsy. So this technology was developed for spinal cord injury, and we're trying to apply what the knowledge base of that to kids with CP, and because it's very fatiguing for spinal cord injury, but we're hoping it'll work well for kids with CP. So here we have. Yes. what's your name?
Oh, Michelle.
Thank you very much, Michelle. So Betty and Jay have put markers on Michelle, on bony landmarks that we identify so that we can put them on in the same place each time. And we have sort of a limited set here. We have the 8 cameras, digital cameras, mounted up on the wall, and they're basically just picking up the light reflection from the markers, and then what's already calibrated, the space here has been calibrated, and the software knows that the markers are in a certain place. It will then calculate the joint center, so we're not actually looking. The motion is based on joint centers that have been derived from the placement of the markers. And so now we're going to go ahead and ask Michelle to go ahead and start walking, starting with your right foot. Just straight ahead, uh-huh. Okay, great. So you saw a red arrow, and okay, walk.
Yeah, just keep walking back and forth.
So the red arrow is actually the floor reaction force. Right. It's okay. Maybe plan to stop a little bit, a few steps before that. There you go. Okay, and now go back and forth. So combining the floor reaction force, that red arrow, with the kinematics that we get from the markers, the joint motion, gives us those kinetic data that we looked at, the moments, the plantar flexion moment, the knee flexion moment, and the hip moments. And so it's the combination of the information from the force plate and the information from the markers that gives us the kinetics. Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you want to come stand in the middle of the room here, with maybe a foot on each plate? And you can turn around if you want to be looking at it, so you're not looking into the light. There you go. Okay. Right. So let's see what you have to do to get those arrows the exact same height. And they're very sensitive. No, we don't. It's not. We look at postural balance on this force plate that's above the floor here, but I want you to see how, you know, very responsive those arrows are to weight shift.
If you balance on one foot.
I don't know.
Yeah, lift one off the ground. There you go. Good. So one thing that's kind of interesting about, crouch gait is that for every degree your knee is flexed, try now flexing your knee, bend your knee. No, stand on both feet and then just bend down. Uh-huh. Right. Mm-hmm. Good. So for every degree you bend down, or let's just say for every 10 degrees you bend down, you have a 40% increase in the forces across your knee. So you're creating a much greater load on your body and a much greater demand, and therefore the gait becomes very fatiguing. And that's because you combine to get the kinetics again. Her arrows aren't any much higher, but because of the angle of the knees, the kinetics are much higher, and the demands on her knee. Right. Right. It's what you see is the location of the arrow is now behind her knee. Can you change direction? Oh, yeah, here you go. I think we might need to have you face the other direction. Uh-huh. Good. Yes. Right, just like that. Mm-hmm. Right. And then bend your knee. Now, how about just go ahead and walk back and forth with bent knees? Especially when you're over the force plate. Okay.
Yeah, sort of
crouch down. Right, yeah. There you go. Good. See how the arrows are behind her there? That's creating a huge demand in the front part of her knee because it has to compensate.
Mm-hmm. There are people who actually sit, and I forget the name, but people who sit totally squatted with their feet flat on the ground.
Uh-huh.
And I know that a lot of people from Western cultures have difficulty doing that. They can do it all. Over time, training, they stretch out, and they can do it. So is that something that's just, is it just a sense of, you make the body go in a different way?
The body is so responsive to its customary use.
Okay.
And so I would guess it's more, exactly, yeah. And so I bet kids start pretty young doing that. And yeah, you're making me want to see if I can still squat all the way down. Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's good, like Tai Chi and other exercises, to get those extreme ranges, but it's a challenge.
I had a lot of squats like yesterday, so I'm kind of sore.
Uh-huh. Okay, we're going to let you sit down. Does anybody have any questions? We have to let Michelle sit down. Okay. So the processing, of course, we connect the dots and end up with graphs, and that's gait analysis.
Right. The software has really progressed. I mean, the last 25 years. I mean, I remember that they were very lucky to figure out where the dots were.
I know, it's really true. We've made good progress, and we're now doing this for other kinds of motion. The gait analysis has been around for quite a while, but yeah.
I think somebody had a question in how many gait analysis labs there are. I mean, if it's mm-hmm. all research or clinical.
Mm-hmm. So at Stanford, we're fortunate. We've got 4 motion analysis labs, and so this is the only clinical motion analysis lab. In other words, we see patients and we you know, make recommendations, treatment recommendations. There's a motion analysis lab in the Clark Center, and they focus on things like that biomechanical model, the hamstring model that I talked about. And then there's a great motion analysis, Tom Andriaki's in the Duran building, and they look at, they've looked at a lot about joint replacement prosthetics and the effect of moments and how they affect the forces on the joints and how do you replace joints in a, you know, very constructive way. And they also are focusing on markerless motion capture, which is really important. We really all want markerless motion capture.
So they, that would be all a video technique?
It is video technique, yep, video-based. But they scan the person just like apparently they do in Rome in the high fashion. They scan a person for their size, so they scan a person. And then they input about several different planes of that person into a software program, and it is all based on video. So it's just lets you have a very flexible. Okay, so wait, Betty's going to explain right here about connecting the dots.
Oh, yeah. So each marker has its own label. So when we process the joint, it will tell us what marker it is. And then when we put it on the joint, it will tell us what
frame. Yeah. Okay. I think that'll do it. If you have questions, feel very free to contact me about it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jessica.
I do want to take this chance to also plug FES, Electrical Stimulation. It's a very promising technology, and if you guys get a chance to hear about that and or learn about it, I think it has tremendous potential for rehabilitation and something we'd love to see a project one of these years.
Okay, any further questions? If not, I want to thank Jessica once again for...